Climbing Gold is a production of Duct Tape Then Beer. Hazel, this is your actual house in Wales?
Yeah.
So excited. You're so adult.
I know. I'm such an adult now.
Yeah.
So weird.
Yeah.
January 2022.
So are you, though. You're way more advanced in on the adulting scale than me.
Yeah.
You're like ready to be a father and stuff.
Yeah, I'm older too, right?
He's a Finley interview.
Yeah, a bit. You're 35 now?
I'm 36.
All right. And a half.
Yeah, see, I've got
I'll
a head start.
I'll be 33 this year.
Oh, yeah, see, there you go.
Okay, we're rolling. Hazel, will you give us the basics?
Yeah, I'm Hazel Findlay, and I've been climbing for, 26 years now. And I grew up climbing in the UK, mostly sea cliff climbing with my dad.
Hazel is a pro climber and mental strength coach. She's street climbed El Cap 4 times, climbed 514C on gear, and is one of the very best at the unique, scary, and dangerous craft of British trad climbing.
Hazel's just a great climber. She's composed, methodical, thoughtful. She's really good at venturing into the unknown.
Are you a Harry Potter fan?
Yeah, of course.
I don't know if you've ever heard of climbing like referred to as like, you've got wizarding families and muggle families. I was from like a half wizarding, half muggle family, where like my mum's a muggle and my dad was a wizard. My dad was like the cool father who like did really fun, exciting, adventurous things with us. My parents were divorced. Yeah, so like every other weekend or in the holidays, we'd go climbing. And he was just a massive fan of the sea cliffs. And I think the main reason why is because we don't have a whole lot of wilderness left in the UK. And the sea cliffs still feel kind of wild. They're like these untouched bits. You don't get tourists, roads, stuff like that. And as soon as you drop down onto the sea cliffs, it's like just you and the nature and stuff. So yeah, just followed my dad really. Didn't really have a choice until I became an adult.
I really like thinking of your dad as a wizard.
Yeah. I think some of the more like profound moments I had were actually when I was younger, growing up doing this sort of thing. I think it's really unusual to be a 12-year-old girl and like be on a cliff, like thinking, oh no, if I mess this up, I might be in the ocean with like a rack that weighs almost more than me, like dragging me to the bottom of the seabed, And I I remember just being in floods of tears on some of these routes. And like, I'd look down and my dad would be like chain smoking, rolling tobacco like as he's belaying me. And, it's just like, I think some of those, having those kinds of experiences when you're young really shape you. I'm not sure in what kind of way, but definitely, probably profound ways. I don't know.
Did you understand the risks you were taking then?
Both my parents, especially my dad, like empowered us to make risk decisions from a really early age. So for us, it was normal to make decisions about our own well-being and our own safety from very young. We live in such a safetyist society. I don't know. I feel like we're probably lacking in those skills a bit. So in some ways, I feel really lucky that we experienced those sorts of decisions from a young age.
Those sorts of decisions, the dangerous ones, the scary ones, the things that intimidate us. At its root, climbing asks us a simple question. Do you want to go up or do you want to go down? No matter what type of climbing each of us prefers, whether it's sport, trad, bouldering, indoor, or alpinism, we will face that question. And that answer for each of us comes down to what we are willing to risk in that moment. Failure. Discomfort, falling, a prolonged epic, a trip to the ER, and even sometimes death. That is the game of climbing. In season 3 of Climbing Gold, we're going to explore risk, how we take risks, and what climbing can teach us about risk-taking away from the wall. And when it comes to this kind of decision-making, there's probably no better place to start than the United Kingdom, where out of necessity, historic precedent, and a stubborn creative aesthetic, a spirit of adventure and danger has been preserved on cliffs that rarely exceed 200 feet. Alex, in all your travels, have you ever come across anything like British trad climbing?
I have never climbed anything quite like the UK trad scene. And it's really hard to overstate how different it feels. In the UK, you're frequently considering whether or not you'll hit the ground when you're climbing. And it's totally normal to plan for your belayer to jump off a cliff or something to pull slack in faster in case you fall off. I mean, like, it's totally normal to have what they call a ground runner, like a piece of gear at the ground so that your belayer can run straight backward and pull slack in faster. Because normally if a belayer runs backward, you know, they're making a triangle to the first piece. So you're actually not pulling in that much gear. Like for each step they go backward, they're only pulling in the hypotenuse of rope as opposed to the actual straight line.
Oh, you're doing math, man.
Yeah, well, exactly. So think like, anyway, so that's the thing is like, basically there's strategies and their tactics involved in UK climbing that you don't even think about in the rest of the world. It's just so next level. You know, the gear, it's like everything about it is just like turned up to 11.
Today, we bring you the story of a calculated risk gone wrong on one of Britain's most famous routes.
James McAfee is a dark horse climber. I mean, nobody's really heard of him, but he's probably the best trad climber in the world. He's not just onsighting difficult trad routes, he's onsighting difficult and dangerous trad routes. James McAfee's whole experience on Master's Wall is the stuff of nightmares. I mean, it's everything that I just can't, it's like, it's just crazy. It's just so much. Like every aspect of the story is so over the top.
Hazel Finley sticks around to help make sense of it all.
I'm Alex Honnold.
I'm Fitz Cahal.
You're listening to Climbing Gold. So, can you explain what the UK trad scene is like? Broad strokes, like paint with a broad brush here.
You could also just keep using Harry Potter references too.
Yeah. Or translate it all into Harry Potter. That'd be.
I'm trying to think what like British trad climbing would be like in terms of the houses. Mm. I don't know. Maybe Hufflepuff. The UK has a very long history of climbing, right? It's like mountaineering and then rock climbing. Even though we don't have big mountains, you know, some of the best mountaineers in the world have come from the UK. And for single pitch trad climbing, I think the UK has got some of the best in Europe. And we don't have a lot of it, which means that a lot of the climbing has been done already. So that we sort of had to make the most of it. And I think that's where some of our trad ethics come from. We've had to preserve the challenge. So it just means that you have routes that are very challenging mentally because there's just not really much protection. In America or somewhere, a lot of the trad routes will be following crack systems, right? And it's almost like crack climbing is synonymous with trad climbing, right? For a lot, in a lot of places, yeah. Whereas we don't really have any cracks. That's what's so weird. We have very few. We don't have any pure crack climbing places. And in general, we have few cracks. So all of the trad, or most of it, is face climbing and generally not following any obvious features whatsoever. That's why on-site climbing is so difficult. Is not only is it hard to find places to protect the climbs, but it's also just hard to find the way. And there's also a real on-site ground-up ethic, particularly ground-up. As soon as you abseil in or top rope something first, then, you know, the style has just dropped massively, right? And people will save routes to on-site them for years and years to the point when no one does anything. But yeah, that's what people are into.
I remember that as a feature of my trip to climbing on the grit was like half the local guys had been saving routes for their entire lives. And you're like, at what point are you actually going to climb the routes?
Yeah.
Like, who cares if you onsite it or not? Just climb the route. Yeah. It's like better to have done it in poor style than to never do it.
Totally. They're just going to top rope it when they're 70.
Yeah, exactly. I always remember, you know, I was like, I don't really get it. Especially because as a visiting American climber, when you're just trying to do as much as possible on a 6-week trip, you're like, wait, why have you been sitting on this route for, you know, 10 years, like just go climb it.
Yeah. Like, I used to save routes when in my 20s. And then as soon as I traveled, I was like, wow, there's a whole world out there. There's no reason for me to save routes. In the UK, you do have to worry about hitting the ground most of the way up through, whereas nearly everywhere else, you don't need to think about it. The way you on-site a British trad route is really between the pieces of gear. It's quite different to on-siting a route in the States where the gear is quite obvious. You can focus more on the movement. Whereas in the UK, it's like there's so much more to think about because, yeah, you might be in the crux, but that might be the only place where you can get gear for the next 10 meters. So even though you're in the crux and you're getting pumped out your mind, you need to get that piece of gear in. So you're kind of weighing up all these decisions in your mind. And it's really challenging.
So to accommodate the emphasis on on-siting and a tendency towards danger, the British use their own rating system, a technical grade that rates the single most difficult move on the route, and an E grade, which coupled with the technical grade gives you a sense of the consequences.
That's the thing is, it's weird, but then actually once you use them for a while, I actually kind of preferred it in a way because it tells you a lot more about the experience. Like when you see something as 10B, you're like, well, what does that mean? You know, like how is that going to feel? Whereas when you get to know the E grades pretty well, you know, if something's like E6, 7A, it like tells you a lot about what you're going to experience.
That would be something like akin to a well-protected 513. An E6, 6B, now making a mistake there, that can mean hitting the ground.
You know, most sort of completely terrifying moments don't last that long in climbing, right? Like even last summer, I tried to on-site this route and you know, I read the route a little bit wrong. I should have been like a meter above where I was and ended up doing this quite wild move and like looking down beneath my feet being like, yeah, if I mess this up, I'd be so close to the ground or hit the ground, right? And just feeling like this sort of the terror and the stress of that, but still managing to actually move well on the rock. That's quite cool. When you have those kinds of experiences, it's really empowering when you're like, wow, the consequences of this are actually really quite high, but I'm still like in control of my body and I'm still climbing well and I'm making good decisions. Like they're pretty cool moments, but they don't last that long. So, you know, you'll remember them, but it's not like you'll be going home like questioning, you know, questioning life and death.
Most of the time. Hazel, would you introduce CAF for us?
James McCaffey is probably the best British UK trad climber, I would say. He's well known for really hard head points, but probably more so for his on-sighting. He will have on-sighted so many E6, E7s, E8s in the UK, you know, stuff that just hasn't been on-sighted by anyone else since. So he's just climbed the most extensively and the hardest routes in the UK, basically, out of anyone.
He's like Mr. UK Trad.
Yeah.
And he kind of fits the persona too, huh? He's like...
Yeah. He's also known as the Dark Lord.
After the break, an epic for the ages on Master's Wall, and we see if we can keep the Harry Potter references going. Climbing Gold is brought to you by the North Face. I've been a North Face athlete for 17 years, which has been incredible, and I've always appreciated their commitment to exploration. Summit Series is the name of the pinnacle North Face products that I use on every expedition, and I love that their tagline is athlete tested and expedition proven. I've personally tested these products all over the world, and they've always proven themselves. Future Fleece is the next generation base layer that I wore every day of my recent summer expedition to Alaska. You can shop the full Summit Series collection at thenorthface.com.
guess on harder routes, I'm better now. But when I was 18, 19, I was miles better at dangerous routes.
Most American climbers think of runouts as like, oh, that's dangerous. But what you're describing is like something being run out is fine. It's just whether or not you'll land on the ground that's actually dangerous.
Exactly, yeah. Basically, if the majority moves, you're going to land on the ground. I see that as a dangerous route. And, you know, and I guess that's where Indian faced massive war. They are, yeah, that sort of route was just now and then, then maybe there might be a climb that you want to do that does have a bigger element of danger. And then it just depends on your desire and your self-awareness as well. Yeah, I'm James McAfee and I've been climbing since 1996.
James is probably the best trad climber in the world. I should just say calf. Everyone just says calf. James McAfee, calf. I bet he's on-sided more 512 and 513 trad routes than anyone else ever, which is saying something. How did you get into climbing?
I think I fancied a girl and she went to the climbing wall. So I went there and then really liked the movement, you know, and then my dad was a climber. So he'd been climbing all his life, but he used to bike down the Borrowdale Valley. And I used to think he was an idiot. He was wasting his time. Looking at it from a kiddie perspective, you know, I was just like, what's he doing biking down there, climbing in these rocks? And then but I got him to take me out and up a classic Sevilla. So it's like five, six, you know, really quite easy climb called Troutdale Pinnacle. He'd done it over 1,000 times and we did it. And then from that, after that, just almost every day, you know, when you've suddenly got the bug, every opportunity it's down this really beautiful valley, the Borrowdale Valley in the Lake District, very green, lots of beautiful trees, just like a little paradise. But so my first lead was awful. Dad was like, I don't know if you're ready for it. And I set off leading this, like, I think it's VS4B, Brown Slabs Crack. And when things are different on the lead and you haven't realized quite how different they're going to be, how more head game it is. And I had like disco leg and I fell off and I had really shit gearing and then carried on. And Dad had bad eyesight because he only had one eye. Oh my God. He could tell that things weren't good, you know, and he was really pissed off with me that I'd, you know, gone all out on this route. I kind of shouldn't have at first.
How did your dad lose his eye?
Yeah, he was in a gang and they were having some fight in somebody's house and he got kicked out the door. And this is a bit of a tall story. I mean, he was full of tall stories, Dad. And he reckoned that a load of people piled under the door and trapped his head in it. And that the guy who had thrown out the back of the house came back and bottled his eye. So that's how he reckoned he lost his eye or lost his vision in his eye.
Well, that's the UK trad scene, huh? That is hardcore. Will you describe Clogy for us?
Yeah, so it's on the highest mountain in Wales, which isn't that high. You know, it's 3,000 feet or around 1,000 metres. So Snowdon, I mean, the Welsh name is Rwythe. And Clogwyn Diathi, that means the Black Cliff in Welsh. It's on the side of it, this mountain, quite high up. Well, it's about halfway up, more or less, maybe two-thirds height. So in, you know, Wales is very wet. So it's in North Wales, quite dark facing. It only gets the sun, gets a bit of sun in the morning on that face I mentioned, and then it gets the evening sun. The rock goes quite greenish and it's a bit slippery.
And in the middle of it, there's this beautiful band of rock called Indian Face.
Is it even beautiful? It's like, I don't really think it's that beautiful. It's just a fucking piece of rock. I mean, that's the bummer of UK climbing is that the roots aren't. It's not like you're like, that's an amazing wall. You're just gonna like, fuck, it's just another piece of rock. But anyway, have you seen? I mean, Clogy is like a mountainside. It's not even like, it's not a striking cliff. It's just
kind of
like
Indian Face is the prettiest part of a not very pretty.
Of like a rubbly rock. Mountainside. Yeah. So you're kind of like, oh, it's like a mountain of rubble. And then there's like, yeah, a little piece of decent rock. But you're kind of like, is that cool? Whatever. It's so easy to make fun of British climbing.
We're about to receive so much hate mail.
Clogy has a beautiful face that's home to two iconic routes, the Indian Face and Master's Wall, which share the same start, but then branch off of each other. Both routes are very serious trad climbs in which a mistake could easily lead to landing on the ground.
These routes, they've got a lot of history. And it starts with one of British climbing's larger-than-life characters, John Redhead.
He was trying this wall, so he'd abseiled it. You know, he'd checked it all out. And I think it used to have a peg about two-thirds height, like downward pointing, not very good, but something to aim for. And he climbed up quite high, and God knows, he fell from about two-thirds height. So I don't think he was quite on Indian Face, but on what called Master's Wall, fell off. Fuck knows how he survived. There isn't any good kit. You know, it's like there's hooks and some really shockingly bad kit, and it's quite far apart.
Redhead comes back, puts a bolt in at his high point, which is basically like committing a mortal sin.
Jerry Moffat came along, chopped the bolt, nearly died doing Master's Wall, and then Johnny Dawes came along and did a slightly purer line to the left, up the vague groove, where the peg used to be, I mentioned, and then up the head wall, which is a dangerous head wall. You know, the head wall in isolation isn't too hard, but you are going to die if you fall off that head wall. And in fact, you're probably going to cop it most of the way up the route, I would have said. If you go to Spain, you know, it's world-class sport climbing. There's a lot of 7B plus 7Cs that are fucking amazing, really good. And the fact is the Indian face is just that, but without the bolts.
So there's a lot of history, ego, and climbing icons wrapped up on this wall. It's the year 2000. Calf is a teenager who's soloing bunches of hard routes. His head is strong. He's got incredible endurance. And he's been onsighting a string of E7s, basically 512s with very little gear, without very much trouble. Master's Wall gets a rating of E7 6B.
So that's like 513 with tiny wires and hooks placed over edges for gear.
Alex, how often do you place hooks for protection?
I have never placed a hook for protection, I don't think. I have used a hook once. I've literally placed a hook twice, I bet. I did once to drill a bolt or two, maybe a couple times drilling bolts. And then I thought I was going to use a hook once for aid climbing, and then I realized that there was a bolt nearby and I didn't have to use it. But it was in the dark, so I couldn't see that well. But no, I never use hooks. Why would you want to climb a route like that?
But around routes like that, part of it's like the history. And they meant everything to me. You know, when you feel that climbing's definitely worth your life just to push the boat out as far as you can. And especially when I was younger, I was after, you know, finding that point where you see what you can do when you're in desperation.
Since Jerry Moffett first did it in 1983, only two other people had completed Master's Wall. It was Calf's first visit to Cloggy, and he decides he's going to go for it. James is with his friend, Adam Wild, who's also never been to Cloggy before. Neither one knows the big, complex terrain. James sets out.
Generally, over the years, I would have said I'm quite cautious. You know, I'm quite a cautious, slow climber. You know, I had a good head at the time. I was mainly soloing. So that serious routes, like, you know what I mean, like dangerous ones, felt all right.
He's got two ropes so that he can avoid rope drag. And it takes him about an hour to figure out the first third of the route before he gets to the business.
It's that sort of very complex rock that, you know, where there's lots and lots of little things that you could use. And you could make a, you know, it would definitely feel around 7C, you know, to on-site these routes. Route finding is tricky on it. You know, it was unchalked, it was a bit green. It's not super obvious, and the moves aren't easy. And there's probably two or three sequences that I nearly fell off. And then I committed to the main cruxes, and I got to these edges. Now these edges, these crimpers, but your feet aren't very good. And I stood there for a minute or two, working it out. It probably took me over an hour and a half to get there. And I probably spent another hour in that position. And there was a hold, a move above me, but there weren't any proper handholds. You know, not like there's a kind of a crystal thing from my left hand, small side pull low down from my right hand. So I was going, you know, up and down those. Think I can't traverse straight right. The rest foot that's quite famous on, you know, two thirds, three quarter height on Indian face. That was just a bit too far up to my left to reach.
There's no bolts. There's no chalk. There's not a crack to follow. There's no good way to know if he's gone the best way.
Basically, he realized that the route was way harder than other E7s that he'd been onsetting.
I tried all possible options. You know, basically, the move that I would have had to have done is, you know, not much for my left hand, quite a small left foothold, and a spring for a hold above. And if the hold wasn't very good, or wasn't quite really good because I was pretty pumped, I would have fallen off. And I'm glad I didn't go for the move because I would have died. But yeah, I tried all possible options. I was quite, you know, I was quite strong-minded, you know, or just said strong-minded-ish in terms of just wanting to give it absolutely every possible, you know, spark of energy to get up the climb, because I still thought it was E7. Eventually, it did dawn on me, you know, I can't move right. I can't go, I can't commit to this move. So that, you know, it was the final alternative was to untie from the ropes. So I dropped the ropes to Adam.
Can we pause for a moment?
Like, that's kind of messed up.
That, like, have you ever been remotely in a situation where you thought, like, the solution to this is just to untie from the rope and drop it to my partner?
No, I have never been in a climbing situation where I felt like I should untie. I haven't even really heard of many situations like that. I mean, I don't know. No, it's totally crazy.
Like, how hard would it be to
I've had situations where your rope gets stuck or something, and then you've potentially untied, but that's typically on, like, mountain terrain or something, and the rope is, like, looped around some boulder, and you're like, oh, I'll just go sort it out. But I've never... I can't imagine being on a vertical wall, really rock climbing, and decide... I mean, honestly, I don't even know if I can untie one-handed. You know, it's like a lot of the... It's, like, hard to imagine hanging onto a little edge and untying.
So I dropped the ropes to Adam. Adam Wilde, who didn't know the crag, my friend, and said, right, you're going to have to go around and hoon me a rope. But it took him a long time. First half hour, I was fairly confident. But then after an hour went by, I was getting more screwed. And then, you know, it just, after the hour, then things went progressively downhill. My arms was totally spunked. They'd been absolutely nuked for half an hour. Because, like I say, I was probably on it for about 4 hours. And, you know, an hour and a half of thinking I'm going to on-site it, and then an hour of slow realization that I'm, you know, if I go for the move up, I'm probably going to die, and I can't go anywhere else. And then thinking about the options, drop the ropes. You know, so I was on it for quite a while, but eventually I did start to lose my cool, and I started to shout for Adam. I said, Adam, you know, where are you, Adam? Any longer? Every minute was felt a year when said, Adam, you know, when you, where are you, Adam? When you think this is it, sort of thing.
I can't hang on any longer.
Everything was giving way, like the fingertips were bleeding, the tendons, the sinews, you know what I mean? It's just like, I can't hang on any longer. You know, just fingers bleed, you know, most tips bleeding. And I thought, fuck, I am going to die. I'm properly going to die on this bit of rock. It seemed ludicrous. Just the end of my endurance. It was my strongest aspect of my climb, and it was just the end of it, you know, because every minute felt like my last for about half an hour. And eventually a rope appears, so they draped out to my right.
For Adam, it had been epic to find his way to the top of the cliff to help his friend. At that moment, he couldn't see Calf, and he had to guess where he was at on the face below. So the rope ended up 10 feet too far to the right for Calf to reach.
And I could see him, and I thought, fuck, I am going to die seeing this rope.
Did you think about jumping for it?
I'm not a very good jumper at the best of times.
What happened next?
And he pulls them back up and then hoons them.
Adam swings the ropes across the cliff, hoping they will find Calf as they slide across the rock.
So I just grab the bloody ropes. I think I managed to tie some slippery hitch or some shit and just fall about 50, 60 foot in at the base of Ember, the next route right, the C1.
If you caught that, Calf managed to tie a sort of friction hitch, and he jumped, and between the hitch sliding and the rope stretch, he landed 60 feet to the right at the base of another route.
And I'm in bits. And Adam Wilde comes down, he's crying. And we leave the ropes there, we go down. And I couldn't feel my feet for 2 weeks. And I think it was really close to stopping climbing.
It's really the stuff of nightmares. It's like my hands are sweating just imagining the position.
The day after, I went for I went climbing down Cwm Pennant. Oh, I didn't climb, in fact, sorry. We went for a walk. Or not even a walk, we just sat outside of Adam's van, and I dipped my toes in the stream. But I had the best tasting egg sandwich I've ever tasted. You know, when you're just really close to death, and the sandwich just tasted out of this world. I was trying to get some feeling back in my toes, but didn't manage it. Like I say, because I really loved climbing at the time, loved it more than anything else, but that, you know, it was very close to not climbing again.
In 2018, 18 years later, Calf returned to Master's Wall and successfully climbed the route. He felt it ranked amongst the hardest trad climbs he's done in Britain. Early on, you touched on the why. Like, why do these kinds of routes? And you brought up the history of it. And how powerful that can be for people's motivations, why it will accept something that doesn't even sometimes make sense. Some of the most dangerous and famous routes in the UK have these crazy survival stories attached to them, which in a logical world would be like a deterrent to most people, but it's like catnip for some people. Could you two talk to me about that?
So, some of your climbing heroes, certainly for me, like in the past, there's routes that I wanted to do because they're kind of my old climbing heroes, and you're treading in their footsteps when you're doing their routes. Do you know what I mean? And obviously the closer to home, you know, maybe more affinity you have for some of the peoples and the history routes. Because like you're saying, yeah, some of the stuff I look back on, things like the Bells of Bells, it's fucking to rubbish route when it comes down to it. But I stuck my neck out when I was 19 to do it. And I'm sure, yeah, I don't know, for you, you know, similar kind of different motivations for stuff close to your home.
There's something to be said for the difference between your intrinsic motivations and your extrinsic, you know, because the intrinsic motivation will get you up a lot of things and you'll take a lot of risk for the intrinsic. Like, I just want to feel, I want the experience of climbing. I want to enjoy the movement. I want to be up there without a rope. You know, it's like, it feels incredible. But the extrinsic motivation is where the history of a route comes in, the culture of it, like the reputational side of it, like knowing that you could be the first to do something, knowing that no one has ever done it before in that style. I mean, those kinds of things. And, you know, it's like, I mean, there's nothing wrong with getting some motivation extrinsically. I mean, like having external factors help motivate you to do something difficult. I mean, you know, that's fine as long as it's not, as long as your ratio isn't skewed too far, you know, one way or the other. And I think the history and the culture of climbing, I mean, a lot of that taps into the extrinsic motivations, I think.
There's obviously more climbers today than there were in the 1980s or even in 2000, but does this ground up on-site style, has it gotten equally as popular, or is it still a thing?
The like you're saying, when we talk about dangerous routes, they have gone a bit, certainly on the on-site manner, they've gone a bit out of vogue.
Why do you think that is?
Well, because you're going to die on them.
Besides the obvious.
Yeah, I guess. I just think it's gone out of vogue. I think it's gone from quite dangerous ideals in the 80s to progressively safer and safer ideals over the last 25 years.
After the break, we do more math and we talk mountain lions.
Alex? Thoughts?
Oh man, spending an hour just treading water, like hoping to figure something out, and then to untie your rope and, you know, have sort of maybe a half hour of hopefulness where you're like, okay, it'll be fine. My partner's going to get me. It's all good. You know, in some ways that would be a moment of great relief where you untie, where you're like, okay, well now I'm done trying. Now I'm just going to get rescued. This is going to be great. But then as the time drags on and you realize that you're not getting rescued that fast, and then you start to panic a little with like, am I just going to die here while waiting to get rescued? I mean, everything about it is so terrible. Like the idea of just being on the wall for 4 hours.
I think it's so crazy too, the amount of sway and that ethics and history have over British climbing. Like in one light, it's just so impressive and proud. And then you take a step back and it's like auditioning for the Darwin Awards. Technically, it just seems so unnecessary. Like there'd be a safer way to do this. And that's how the rest of the world does it, really.
But part of it is a cultural thing too, where you're like, this whole scene is so freaking weird. So like in Hard Grit, there's a...
Hard Grit was a VHS era climbing film. It's basically a cult classic.
Like the first ascent of this route, Meshuggah, which is, I think, supposed to be E9 or E8 or something. It's like quite a hard grade down. And so when he climbs it, he climbs this big, hard arete feature, and then he places like one piece of gear and then he tops out. But so when I visited the Grit, I repeated that route, and it turns out it's basically like a 12D arete solo, or like a really high ball V6, maybe like 20 or 30 feet or something. And then there's a little break where you can get gear, and then there's like a 510 exit or something. And I was like, this is completely stupid. Like, why would you carry gear and a rope and have a belayer and have all this stuff if you have to solo all the hard climbing anyway? I was like, this route is just a free solo. But, you know, the first ascensionist did it with a rope and gear because he's like, he's going trad climbing. And I was like, this isn't trad climbing. This is soloing. You know, it's like, if you're doing all the hardest moves with no protection, that's freaking free soloing. Like, why bother wearing a harness? You know, like, why have training weight on while you go free soloing? It's totally stupid. The whole UK trad scene is just a totally different world.
Did you like it?
Well, yeah, I mean, kind of, you know, it's like, yeah, I'm all worked up of like, it's so crazy, it's so stupid. And then I'm like, you know, but I did have a good time. I did have some meaningful experiences for sure.
So this season on Climbing Gold, we're going to dive into the topic of risk. We've got 7 stories about people taking chances. Sometimes people are drawn to these powerful moments in their lives by history, others by visions of the future, sometimes by curiosity, and at other times simply out of necessity. We'll traverse from the mind of a thinker who has dedicated her life to understanding why we zero in on some risks while completely ignoring the obvious ones, all the way to the frozen faces of the planet's biggest mountains. Alex, you also have thought a lot about this topic in your career. I think a really good place to start would be to just ask, how do you define risk?
Well, I think the definition of risk is just a situation involving exposure to danger. I just looked that up. And so the way I've always talked about risk is the severity of the outcome times the likelihood of the outcome. You know, the risk of something being the total of the likelihood of something happening and how serious it will be if it does happen. Mm-hmm. The reason you have to think about it is like multiplying factors there is because there are a lot of things in climbing that are clearly very high consequence, like climbing without a rope. You're sure that you're going to die if you fall off. So you're like, that's incredibly high consequence. But the likelihood of falling off is often very, very low if the terrain is easy and the rock is solid. And so in a situation like that, it's actually not that risky, despite the fact that people often use the term risky to describe that circumstance. You know, it's like people look at free soloing pictures, they're like, that's really risky. And you're like, well, no, because the likelihood of falling is very, very low, even though the consequences would be very high.
Could you expand on that? Like, could you use the equation to compare, say, sport climbing to high ball bouldering?
With sport climbing, the consequences of a fall are negligible. I mean, they're not quite zero because you can occasionally, you know, twist your ankle maybe. But really, you know, most sport climbing falls are very safe. And so even though you're going to take many, many falls, or, you know, hundreds of falls as a sport climber, just they're not going to matter. You know, they're just safe.
They're part of the game.
Yeah.
And bouldering?
There's a lot of uncertainty involved with it. Because if you get high enough, you're like, yeah, you could break your ankles, but like, what if you miss the pad and you fall over backward and you crack your head on a boulder? Like, you can start imagining sort of what if sort of scenarios with high ball bouldering where you're just not totally sure what might happen, because realistically, you've never fallen from 25 feet up and you're not totally sure where the landing is going to be. And you don't really know what'll happen if you fall that far and you bounce off the pad. Like, will you bounce or will you just crater into the pads? Like, you don't really know because you've never done it, because you are sort of multiplying out the likelihood of falling versus the consequences, but you don't totally know what the consequences might be. Like, they might be fine, so it might be fine to fall from up high, but you don't really know, you know, and you don't want to be the one that finds out by having, you know, your tibia shoot through the pad like a harpoon, you know, which happens sometimes.
Oh man, I have like the shivers right now.
So you're saying high ball bouldering is more risky than sport climbing?
Yeah.
Figuring out how to take good risks is one of the biggest challenges of life. It's a hard thing to do, and even seeing the risks that we are taking can be hard to do.
Well, I think that humans will always struggle with objectively evaluating risk, just because some risks capture the imagination in a really dramatic way. You know, like the idea of getting eaten by a shark or attacked by a lion or, you know, taken down by a mountain lion while you're out jogging.
Having to untie from your rope.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, those are things that capture the imagination and give you nightmares and really kind of stress you out. But the idea of, you know, getting heart disease or something over 30 years of eating a poor diet, like, that doesn't really capture the imagination in the same way. It doesn't sort of inspire horror in the same way. And so despite the fact that you're much more likely to die from heart disease than you are from a mountain lion attack, you'll probably spend far more time worrying about mountain lions when you're out in nature. The thing is, I think when we think about physical risks, we experience a more visceral reaction, which is what we normally call fear. But I think when we take financial risks or, you know, emotional risks, things like that, we don't really call it fear in the same way a lot of the time. I mean, people will be like kind of giddy or excited or like on edge or stressed, or, you know, like they'll have different terminology, like different verbiage to describe the sensation of fear that comes around taking other kinds of risks. And I never really thought about this, but it is kind of interesting that, you know, when we talk about fear, we're normally talking about the physical side of fear, like something might happen to your body. But, you know, when you're taking other kinds of risks, you're still sort of experiencing the same thing, like deep dread or like, oh God, you know, something terrible could happen. But you normally just sort of hide it with other terms, you know, like, oh, I'm just feeling a little cranky today, or, you know, like, oh, I just don't, you know, it's like, when's the last time a hedge fund manager was like, I'm just so scared today? You know, it's like, I mean, people be like, oh, this is a big, like, this is a big play. I'm not sure if I'm making the right choice. This is sketchy, you know, but then they like go do a couple lines of coke and they're like, it's fine. And you're kind of like, no, you're fucking gripped. Like, this is the same as walking on the side of a cliff. Like, you know, this is scary. Mm-hmm. But it's like, really, you're afraid because you're taking a risk.
You know, I would imagine at some point or another, you've both heard someone who makes a habit of engaging in physical risk defend their choices by saying kind of something like, well, people die every day in cars, or you could get hit by a car crossing the street. Like, I think you've probably heard that. And when I hear that, like, I know they might just be like struggling to explain themselves, but I'm like, I hope you don't actually approach the risks you're taking with that thinking.
No, it's not really right. Though, to be fair, I am one of those people who have said things like that in the past, because when you get tired of talking about risk, it's easy to just fall back on the fact that everybody takes risk every day in their life to some extent or another. And, you know, we're always just doing our best to quantify those risks how we can. And it's not always perfect math. Like, it's not that easy to quantify. And so, you know, to some extent, we're all just doing our best and muddling our way through. And so I think when you fall back on sort of crutches like, well, we all drive sometimes, that's just a bit of a, you know, what do you call, like an abdication? You're just kind of giving up on trying to figure it out for yourself. It's like, realistically, extreme sports are extreme for a reason. Like, you know, they are more dangerous. They are riskier. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, that's the challenge of talking about risk, is that every conversation kind of falls back on the, like, but how do you really quantify? Like, how do you really know? Ultimately, it comes down to, like, what do you feel comfortable with? Everybody thinks they're making good choices right up until they get injured or they die. Nobody ever thinks they're being risky, really.
And that's why it's worth talking about.
Yeah.
Thanks, Calf and Hazel, for sharing your stories and perspectives. Climbing Gold is a production of Duct Tape and Beer. Alex Honnold is our host. Today's episode was produced and edited by me, Fitz Cahal, with additional mixing and editing by Matt Martin. Production help by Lauren Delaney Miller, Evan Phillips, Austin Syedak, and Anya Miller. Music today by Brennan O'Connell, Amy Stolzenbach, Cordelia Zars, and me. Our executive producers are Becca Cahal and Lisi Hendricks for Duct Tape and Beer, and Jonathan Retzik and Ben Endy for RXR Sports. Please leave us a review on iTunes and follow along on Instagram @ClimbingGold. It helps us out. Thank you for listening.